Hello and welcome to Aerial Evolution. I'm Jane.
And I'm Rowan. With us today are Elsie Smith and Serenity Smith-Forshawn, founders of Nimble Arts and NECA. In this double-length episode, we bring you a new perspective to our podcast, Twins. Hear all about Elsie and Serenity's surprising introduction to circus and aerial and how that led to a lifelong career working with major companies, including Ringling and Cirque du Soleil, as well as the foundation of their own circus school, the New England Center for Circus Arts.
If you like what you hear and want to join in on the discussion, find us on Instagram or Facebook at Aerial Evolution Pod. We would love to hear from you. And if you want more info on what was discussed, make sure to check out the links in the show notes.
Let's get started.
Hi there.
Hello.
So yeah, we always like to begin our podcast with how you got started with aerial and circus. Elsie, why don't you go first?
So yeah, Serenity and I got a really unusual start in the circus. We grew up in the middle of the woods with no running water and electricity and had lots of brothers and sisters and did a lot of childcare and a lot of animal husbandry. And we were sort of geeks at school and we did no sports, partly because the school we went to was so small that it didn't really have many sports programs, but also because we just, you know, we climbed trees. That was kind of it. We had a chance to try a flying trapeze at a Club Med when we were about 17, and it was super cool. And then a year later, we got a chance to try it again. And at the Club Meds, you know, 30 years ago, they had little shows that they would put together with kids at the end of a week of rehearsals. And, you know, we weren't necessarily kids, but they could tell we were excited. And they said, would you like to try, for me, swinging trapeze and Serenity Spanish Web? And that was our first chance to perform because we'd not really been on stage before. And it was sort of, you know, that high of being on stage was pretty amazing. So we went back to university. And I found out from a friend of mine that she was teaching at a summer camp. And I looked through the little catalog that she had, and I noticed that they had circus. And so my brain went, okay, if she is teaching music, somebody is teaching circus. I wonder how you get that job. So we called up and they basically hired us as apprentices in the circus program at the summer camp. And we kind of never looked back after that. We just kept going with various things in the circus.
That's awesome. And then how did that move from apprenticing at a summer camp to performing with some of the most well-known companies in probably the world?
Sort of a brief explanation of that is that at that summer camp, there was a woman who had been a performer on Ring Brothers. And she said to Elsie and I, you know, you guys are good teachers, but I think you're actually physically good at this stuff too. And she invited us to audition for a position that came open at Ringling Brothers. Essentially, they train dancers to do aerial web. And this was in 1988. And I was the one who was available because by then, Elsie had moved to Canada to keep teaching and working with a gentleman who she had met. So I sent in photos and a letter and a resume that just basically said, I kind of like circus and, you know, maybe this is a chance. I have no idea why they hired me with that little bit of a resume. I think they might have been a little bit desperate to find someone who was ballsy enough to try it. And I was hired by Ringling Brothers to join in December of 1989, I think is what it would have been. And I learned by doing it. I learned by watching, by mimicking, by working hard backstage, and got to live on a train for 6 months and met a lot of really interesting people. From there, you know, if you're a personable person and they have a job opening, they tend to look for their friends. And I ended up getting an inquiry from the Pickle Family Circus in San Francisco. They were looking for an aerialist. In between there, I had gone to Japan for almost 9 months with another touring mud show to get some experience as probably a showgirl would be the best term for it. So, you know, doing a lot of various aerials, but mostly dancing, trying to do pull-ups in the backstage. So by the time the Pickle Family Circus came looking for an actual main stage performer, I had gained a lot more skills. And that's what took me to San Francisco in 1992. Elsie then came to join me in San Francisco. And after 5 years with the Pickle Family Circus, and at the time, Elsie was working as a shoe salesperson, Elsie and I started working together about 5 years later. And in 1997, started traveling and performing as a duo trapeze act, and then auditioned for Cirque du Soleil and eventually got in. It took a couple of tries.
That's quite an origin story.
Yeah, we were doing a lot of teaching with social circus programs, and I got connected with the competitive trampoline world in Canada. So we dabbled in a lot of other things and just met a lot of people and learned a lot about the world. But it was a long time before we ended up working together. And Serenity had been working professionally for quite a while before I joined her. And we were teaching at the circus school in San Francisco that is now called the Circus Center. And both of us had at different point in times been administrators there and lead aerial coaches. You know, we'd get up early in the morning, sneak in, and then I would head off to work at the shoe store that I ran, and Serenity would go work for the Pickle Family Circus. And we slowly put an act together and then auditioned for a company called Cirque La Masque, and then got a couple of contracts under our belts. We had auditioned for Cirque du Soleil a couple of times, and as Serenity mentioned, we're not successful because we didn't have a tumbling background. We didn't have a gymnastics background. But eventually they headhunted us because they realized they needed identical twins who did trapeze for the relaunching of their signature show, Saltimbanco, that was going to go tour in Asia.
Very cool.
Your work now, do you do still circus, or would you say it's more aerial dance?
That's a really interesting question, because there's no real clear definition of either circus or aerial dance. I have done, especially through the Pickle Family Circus, which is an ensemble show, I've juggled on stage, I've done tumbling on stage, I've done teeterboard and Korean plank and circus pole. My ex-husband and I for years did a partner acrobatic act. So, you know, with that diversity of background, I would say Elsie and I are circus artists, not just aerial dancers. But it is a really interesting question to bring up. What is aerial dance? Where does it lie in between circus and dance? Is it part of one or the other?
And our initial experience with circus was definitely circus. We toured with a company called Circus of the Kids, teaching kids. We taught fire reading, trick roller skating, tight wire, you know, classic circus acts, and classic from the Sailor Circus, Florida State University, Ringling Brothers lineage. And then obviously we worked with the circus school in San Francisco and went off to tour with Cirque du Soleil. And we really discovered aerial dance when we came off tour and started teaching at the Aerial Dance Festival in Boulder, Colorado. And I know you have interviewed Nancy Smith, who is an awesome lady and just created an incredible world. And she has a real passion for aerial dance. And she really kept that vision, even as circus kept enticing people away from aerial dance. We've really just sort of continued to meld it all. And, you know, I can't say I do one versus the other.
Were there aspects of history, either from the traditional, the contemporary, the aerial dance, that you were specifically taught along the way?
I would actually say that my own personal journey was actually timed with the uptick of circus in the United States. So that came from a bunch of different places, an uptick of circus education, not just the performing part of it. So in the late 70s and early 80s, we started to get more of an appreciation and a homegrown circus. But it was sort of the late 80s where we had a combination of a bunch of different things happening. Sailor Circus and the Florida State University sort of had graduated a bunch of people that started to create their own programs. One of those was the program that we started with, which was called Circus of the Kids. It was actually started by someone who initially set up a trampoline and a swinging trapeze at Club Med. So Bruce Pfeffer was the person who originally instilled the idea of circus at Club Med, which is sort of a public access circus idea. Bob Christians is the one who took it to the next step with the flying trapeze and full-on circus programs. But basically, that was a program that allowed the general public in the United States to have access to circus on a recreational basis. And not just circus ground skills, but the full-on flying trapeze, high-flying experience. Simultaneous was the increase of what's called risk recreation. And we don't use that term now because the whole insurance thing is kind of crazy. But back in the 80s, risk recreation was a big thing. You had ropes courses that were coming out. Outward Bound was another thing that was big. And self-discovery through risk recreation was really big. And circus and doing things like flying trapeze and, you know, climbing to the top of the ceiling and dropping on the aerial fabric really molded with that. And then the last piece that was really happening at that time was social circus, where people were starting to teach kids and there were small studios that were opening up, really focused on working with kids and empowering them through this thing called circus. Later on in the 90s, you started to get pole dance studios and some of the exotic dance, the burlesque work, started to fold into the circus then. And you know, bring this back to Serenity and I, we sort of jumped into the middle of all of it. And obviously we're brought up through risk recreation and youth social circus, but then jumped into professional training circus and Cirque du Soleil and then aerial dance. And we just kind of say yes to all of it in our careers. I love everything about circus, everything that it can do. I think there's an amazing place for traditional circus, for street performing, for avant-garde noir circus. I mean, you can label all the different things, but it's basically, you know, taking the awesome ability of the human body and showcasing it to enlighten people. Yeah, so that's like the history of circus from the 80s in a very short period of time in the United States.
And I'd like to add that my introduction to aerial dance was in San Francisco. Again, a really intriguing time that we happened into. In the early 1990s is when Terry Sandgraf, a dancer and a gymnast, started working with what she called motivity bars, so wooden trapezes, very low to the ground. So it was trapeze, it was aerial, but it was very ground-based. It wasn't circus at all. But then over the years, those two things started to blend. The circus tricks people started to bring to the low trapezes, and the aerial dancers on the low trapezes wanted to add circus tricks. And that forced a change in the apparatus. For example, the wooden bars started breaking when people did really big tricks. And so there had to be a whole new carbon fiber trapeze that was light like the wooden bars, but allowed for the safety of doing circus on it. And that's how the single point dance trapeze became a circus apparatus, even though it started in the early 1990s as a wooden trapeze low dance apparatus. And it's also been really interesting for me in the last 10 years. I've done a lot of work in Europe, and that's where Fred Deb, of course, is based, in France. And the history of aerial dance in Europe and the defining of it is very different than it is in the United States. So Europe actually has aerial dance as an identified style of dance, an identified funding stream. You can file grants for aerial dance, whereas in the United States, we don't even know where that sits. Does it sit in dance? Does it sit in theater? In Europe, there's also vertical dance, which is the harness work that's done, and it's identified as a very specific art form. Again, it's not circus, but is it? They all kind of blend in together. And I feel really lucky that I've been able to work at a bunch of aerial dance festivals in Europe, where vertical dance, aerial dance, and circus is all in one giant room. And we're all getting much more juicy and creative because we're able to blend each other's art forms together.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. Some of our other guests have also discussed the distinction between vertical dance, circus, and aerial in regards to Europe. Do you know about the rest of the world?
I don't know specific to vertical dance or aerial dance, but the question of sort of what is circus and what's defined is really intriguing in different places. For example, Africa, there's a very strong acrobatic tradition. In Asia, the theater is where the acrobatics and the circus arts that we know about developed. So China specifically hasn't had aerials very strongly until the last maybe 20 or 30 years, simply because they were performing in theaters that weren't developed for that. So the history in these different places is really unique. And it's hard to talk about the history of circus as a global history, because the history is really different within each country.
One of the things that Serenity and I have surmised over the years about why the Asian aerial movement wasn't as strong as it might have been in other places is that building construction is really different in places like Thailand and things like that. So there's so many nuances about why an art form might take seed in one part of the world versus another part of the world that I think would take a circus historian a long time to sort of dig into.
I was talking to my mom about this. She teaches, and one of her students is Chinese who does pole. And she said that the aerial in China was that it used to be the lower class would do it. And now, because it's become more popular and because it's so expensive, now it's the elite, which I thought was interesting.
I would say that it sort of mimics what happened with pole dance, where you could trace that in the burlesque scene. I have to say, as I express my awareness of the history of circus, this is just my awareness of the history of circus. I could have big gaps. But what I've been able to trace is that the burlesque scene on the West Coast, especially in Seattle, started to embrace circus in the 1990s, probably the mid-1990s. And pole dance and, you know, the dance trapeze that used in an exotic dance environment became really popular. And one could argue that that would be a lower class group of people that might be exposed to that type of apparatus. Fast forward to now, where you have pole dance studios and classes are expensive, and it's a whole different way of getting into pole dance. And it's also becoming mainstreamed into the circus arts. It's matching Chinese pole, which really started to become popular after Saltimbanco with Cirque du Soleil started to be videotaped and put out. I think the Bravo channel may have had Cirque du Soleil on TV. And that's also another way that circus started to become publicized in the 1990s. And then, of course, Vera Kai and some other Cirque du Soleil shows had Chinese pole. And then through the San Francisco lineage with Master Lu Yi, there were several people who graduated from the San Francisco school and went to the National Circus School in Montreal, focusing on Chinese pole. And so basically in the early 2000s, you had this big, you know, mushing together of Chinese pole, and then pole dancing was becoming mainstreamed in studios. And then now you'll go to the circus festival, for example, Cirque du Domaine in Paris had two Chinese pole artists this past year. And one of those was also an aerial pole. So Chinese pole is sort of morphing into aerial pole. And that's all about Chinese pole, basically, and pole dance becoming mainstreamed into circus all over the world.
Interesting. Dovetailing off of apparatus development right now, you two did start on some of the more traditional ones, trapeze, Spanish web. So I was just curious if the act that you guys developed for Cirque, was that done in a more traditional fashion with a double point, or did you also have variations, or did you have one that was a single point as well?
The act that we did on Cirque du Soleil was a duo swinging trapeze act. So it was 2 points. And a lot of what that act stylistically featured was leg to leg, which is actually sort of very traditional skill set that came from a coach in South Africa working with duos. So actually, a Ringling Brothers show that I was on featured an African-American male duo from South Africa doing duo swinging trapeze that featured this leg to leg, which is, it's sort of another conversation, but my experience with circus from the beginning was a lot of diversity, featuring performers who didn't look like me and didn't speak English as their first language from all over the world. Fast forward to when we were with Cirque du Soleil, we actually got to work with the same coach who had worked with those two, the Ayak brothers, Basil Schultz. He came and worked with us so that we could learn the leg-to-leg skills. And he had a very balletic style. And so ballet also is very kind of traditional in an interesting way, even though ballet mixed with circus feels very contemporary. So that's the act that we did for Cirque du Soleil. After we left Cirque du Soleil, we started teaching in a lot of different places, including getting to work with Susan Murphy. Susan Murphy is one of the people who trained with Terry Sendgraf along with Nancy Smith. Susan Murphy had moved to Georgia where she opened Canopy Studio, and she did a lot of that work with the wooden dance trapeze rigged off of a single point. She brought Elsie and I in to teach workshops. So we were teaching circus layered on this aerial dance work that she was doing. And that's where this idea came for us to do a circus act on a single point trapeze, which is the act that we won a few awards at international competitions. So that act was our act. We did that our own selves post Cirque du Soleil. But it definitely came from bridging this gap between this dance trapeze world and our circus world. And also trying to figure out how do you keep a trapeze spinning when you're 20 feet in the air and going to the hardware store and roping things together so you can push on it and inventing a different apparatus.
We've actually made a point in our careers of trying to, A, create acts that we could perform in a wide range of places. So, you know, we put together that single point spinning act so that we could perform it in 16 feet or we could go, you know, much higher than that, partly because we just needed to be able to have income, and diversity of locations gives you diversity of income. But then even after that, we started to really get excited about creating apparatus that were different than what other people were doing, partly because we don't have the same background that a lot of other people had that we were competing against in festivals. We had to find some other way of standing out because we weren't going to stand out with like rhythmic gymnastics, ballet lines, and crazy backbends and things. We had to stand out in a different way. So we ended up creating things like, I did a fabric act that was a bunch of loops looped together. I was inspired by Fred Deb and some of the work that she was doing with her revolving lira, which was an act that she helped developed when she was at circus school in France. And I put that on a single point, and it's now the tippy lira that people do all over the world. And we've done things with a revolving rectangle. So again, we inspired by Fred Deb and the revolving lira, and we have this giant revolving rectangle. And I think it's super fun to invent new things. I think the circus did it for a long time, and now technology is allowing us to even take that to another level.
Yeah, really interesting. Was Cirque du Soleil the first time that you guys really leveraged yourself as identical twins, or was that something that you had done previously? And then what is it like to work with a twin?
So I think that's an interesting question. It didn't occur to us to leverage our being twins because we just simply are twins and we like to work together. My first duo trapeze partner was Aloysia Gavray when I worked for the Pickle Family Circus. So we were duo trapeze partners for maybe 5 years. And it's been really fabulous to watch her career also be very similar but different from mine. So also going to Cirque du Soleil and then starting her own circus school and company. She's done some fabulous work. And Elsie and I started to work together more because we like each other and we needed partners because Aloysia was moving on to work with someone who could actually throw her around a lot more than I could. And there was just an opportunity for a duo trapeze act to audition for a company that was coming into town. So again, it didn't occur to us to leverage that we were twins, but I'm certain it didn't hurt. There's definitely an intrigue about twins, but also for the simple fact that our lines are similar. the aesthetics, the goal of trying to really match each other. You know, when we're trying to make our hands look exactly the same, it's easier when the other person looks the same as well. So it's been a happy happenstance.
It also happened, if we sort of look at the history of circus lens in all of this, traditional partnering in the air was a big male base and a small female flyer. And same size aerial partner work was really not a thing that was seen. And Serenity referenced the Ayak brothers and the work that Basil Schultz was doing in Africa. And he was putting identical twins on the trapeze and working with the leg to leg work. And, you know, it could have happened before then, but I'm not as aware of it. But that really started the idea that same size base and flyer aerial work could be exciting and interesting. Basil Schultz then trained the Stebbin twins, who were the first identical twin aerial duo trapezist on Cirque du Soleil. And then Serenity and I were hired to replace them. So we were sort of from this lineage of new aerial partnering with same size partners. And we had to create a lot of the vocabulary. We weren't the only people creating it, but it was a lot harder to sort of go out there and figure out what the tricks were that you might want to work on, because you couldn't do the standard stuff that was visible when you went to see shows. And now, of course, if we look at the aerial partner work that we see all over, especially in contemporary circus, you frequently see female bases, you see male partners, flyers, you see same size athletes, and I think really diversified what we're able to see.
Stay tuned.
We'll be right back.
You talked a lot about how aerial and circus have changed over the years. Do you have something that you're most excited about?
Wow, that's a really great question. I find myself just getting excited about everything. So I'm hard to put in a box about like the one thing I'm the most excited about. I think it also depends on where I'm at. So I was at the Cirque du Domaine, the Paris Festival last year. Well, I guess it was just February 2020, but it was their last show. And there was a lot of stuff on that stage. And for those of you who don't know that festival, it's one of the top competitions in the circus world, but they're focused on new or young and up and coming artists. And I saw things like the duo Hair Hang Act that won several awards, and the Aerial Pole Act that also won an award. For me, those weren't new, you know, through the aerial dance or the vertical dance world and the various places that I've worked. I've seen those. They weren't new to me, but they were considered new on the circus competition stage in Europe. And so I was really excited about watching those things develop and enter a different realm on that stage.
That's such an interesting question and really flavored for me right now during the COVID times. So separate from the sort of the creative aspect of circus, I think that we may be in a really interesting time when circus is going to move back outdoors. There's been huge opportunities to create really high level art by moving circus into theaters, just the technology available with lighting and all the other things that you can have in a theater has really created beautiful work. And I'm really intrigued to see over the next couple of years how moving circus and theater of all sorts, entertainment of all sorts, back outdoors, where people, you know, don't have to worry about being in enclosed spaces and COVID, how that might allow circus to be more available to people who can't afford it. I've watched it become more of an elite art form over the last 20 and 30 years, which is sometimes what can happen when there's money put into shows. But it also has been a little disturbing to me how it's become not available to many people. So that is something that I'm super intrigued to observe what happens with it. And I personally, Elsie and I have been actually thinking about this for the last couple of years. One of our personal goals with our company, Nimble Arts, is to bring circus theater and keep it outdoors where anyone can see it. Many times it means it has to be free. So that also challenges how people get access to it. But I think it's an important thing for me. And I hope that the whole theater world also starts to pay attention to that a little bit more.
A really interesting journey that I've been part of. I mean, I've created things that have made circus more elite. I think of the circus school trajectory, how, you know, people for years did circus in fields and in barns and in tents that were set up in Africa. I still get these amazing audition videos from people who are doing circus under a bridge because that's where it's dry and you're doing circus on the beach. And yet, one of the really awesome things that's happened, and I'll speak from the American perspective, is that you can go to a studio in almost any city in the United States and many small towns. You can go to a small studio and learn some aspect of circus, whether it's juggling or aerials. A lot of gymnastics schools now have circus in their spaces. And the circus schools that are at the forefront of education in the United States. So the New England Center for Circus Arts, which Serenity and I co-founded, you've got Circadium, you have Aloft, you have the Circus Center in San Francisco, Sanka in Seattle. I'm sure I'm missing a lot of others. I apologize. But their facilities are amazing. And NECA has been able to actually build a custom-built facility with foam pits and 40-foot ceilings and suspended flying trapezes. And that's awesome because you can go in and you can safely learn lots of circus, and that helps to elevate it as an art form. But those facilities are expensive, and it's this really interesting heart place for Serenity and I to sort of recognize that, you know, speaking of NECA, we've created this amazing space where you can do amazing things, but not everybody can get into it because the cost of running such a building is prohibitive. Obviously, there's fundraising and stuff that we do so that we can have social circus programs and things like that. But when you're looking at the history of accessibility in the circus, these awesome circus schools are creating both accessibility and inaccessibility.
Yeah. I'm going to put a pin in NECA. We have a whole bunch of questions, going to keep them separate. But just backtracking slightly to something that you were talking about in your personal history, which is the different festivals. And in particular, there's this dynamic of competition-based festivals and then the aerial dance festivals. And since you've participated in both of them in various different roles, can you talk a little bit about your experience?
Sure. It's actually odd that the same name is being used because they're completely different things. The circus festivals are circus competitions. They're showcases. Traditionally, before the internet, it's where agents would go to find new acts. It's where artists would go to find contracts. We did one in China. We did one in Mexico. We did one in Spain. And at every one of them, the goal, of course, it's nice to win an award, which we did. But most people are there to actually get contracts because that's, in the end, that's your bread and butter. So that is the model of the circus competition festival. Monte Carlo has the same thing, Cirque du Domaine as well. The aerial dance festivals are actually wonderful week or two long week workshops that also have a performance component to it. Usually the coaches are invited to perform as well, but there's no competition at all. It's really just a giant fun adult camp, maybe. And so it's really just that the name festival is used in both of them, but there's very little parallel in the two.
That's so interesting. So yeah, when we talked to Lindsay, we discussed the Olympics and the differences between aerial being a competitive sport versus being an art form. So since there are these two types of festivals, the competitions and the aerial dance festivals, which aren't competitive, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, I wanted to first just say that my personal experience with circus competitions was very supportive. I think the camaraderie backstage with all of the performers, I've never felt that in a negative way at all. It was always a really positive experience, the three festivals that Serenity and I went to. And I've talked to other people who've said the same thing about, you know, being in Monte Carlo and the Golden Carl and other festivals. There is certainly a level of stress around competition, especially for people for whom doing well and getting a contract is really important. My experience with the Paris Festival this past February was the same. For example, there was a young man who I believe grew up in Romania and he'd been trained in Germany, had a contract for Cirque du Soleil in Las Vegas, where he was in-house troupe. And for him to get a medal at the Paris Festival meant the difference between being able to barely pay the rent in Las Vegas and being able to go out on tour and, you know, send money back home that was going to put food in his parents' mouths. So the stress wasn't because of the performers backstage or the competition between the performers. It was really about just needing to succeed in this world.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I'd have to say that even in a pole dance world, which is where a lot of these sort of mini local competitions are happening, most of them, their goal is really about community building. And I think at a lower level of competition, gymnastics is similar, is that it's about bringing together schools and sharing conversations. I think the stress increases as the skill level increases. So by the time you get to the Olympics, it's a very, very different thing, or aspiring to have gymnastics as a career. And if you get that gold medal, it really is different than if you come in fourth and no one ever hears about you again. So I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with competition, especially if the people who are creating those competitions really keep the community building as part of their goal. So stress happens, but it's not necessarily inherent in the issue of a competition.
I would say one of the differences between sport competition, and we'll use the Olympics as an example, and a circus competition, is that circus competitions, for the most part, are the clowns and the animal trainers and the aerialists and the jugglers and everybody, they're competing against each other. So you're not comparing apples to apples, you're comparing apples to oranges. And it makes the judging really, really difficult. But I think it keeps the performers from comparing themselves trick to trick. It keeps that from happening. And the stress that I think that I see in a competitive sport, I taught competitive trampoline for a little while. And I think one of the stressors that happens is when everybody has to get the back tuck and it has to look like everybody else's back tuck. And if you don't get the back tuck, you can't move on to the next level. Whereas in circus, I don't do back tucks. So I'll do front tucks instead. And if I don't do front tucks, then I'm going to make up a cool new thing that only I can do because of the way my shoulders work. And I can still achieve success, but the competition directly to the human who's standing next to me isn't there.
Yeah, I was going to specifically ask about what the judging is then looking at and how that's different than looking for a specific skill, a specific execution.
I would say the difference between circus competitions and other competitions is because you don't have a specific rubric of comparison. It really does come down to what the judge likes and what the judge considers to be advanced, high-level, gold medal-worthy circus. And for me to judge an aerial act, I'll have a lot more experience with being able to identify whether a skill is unique and highly performed. And then I'll watch an animal act and I can tell you what I like and what I don't like, but I can't tell you what's unique and highly skilled. So from a judging perspective, it's a lot more about what the judges like and don't like. And they can usually express very clearly why they have that reaction to it. But it does, at the end of everything, feel like it's whatever the judges like.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting question because it tends to be pretty subjective. I think some circus competitions list what they want the judges to consider, maybe technical mastery instead of, you know, did they do a double back tuck, for example, it might be a little bit more broad, or the artistry or the level of creativity. I was a judge at Viva Fest a year ago. Elsie did it 2 years ago, and they've created a list of criteria that they're looking at. So I think each competition does something differently.
Stay tuned.
We'll be right back.
Switching gears now, can you talk about the formation of NECA and how that came to existence?
So the formation of NECA was this funny little journey that was basically Serenity and I saying yes to a lot of little things. And then before we knew it, we were founding a national circus school. So after our tour with Cirque du Soleil, we came back to the Vermont area. We grew up in Western Massachusetts and our family had moved just north of the border to Vermont. So it was sort of like coming home. And we started working with Nancy Smith at the Ariel Dance Festival and started doing a lot of teaching, which of course was how we got into circus in the first place. And when we had a couple of months at home, we started subletting from a photographer who had a studio that had about 12-foot ceilings. And we were traveling around the world teaching. And we'd come back to our small town and some people would say, hey, can you teach me? So we'd start to teach a couple private lessons. And then if we knew we were going to be in town for 7 weeks, we offered a 7-week class. We started teaching teacher trainings. So we were helping teachers understand how to spot trapeze and aerial fabric and, you know, the philosophy behind teaching that we'd gained from various things. And before we knew it, we were fully paying that photographer's rent and then some with the hours that we were spending in his studio. So we decided to rent our own studio at a place called the Cotton Mill, which had 16-foot ceilings. And as we were doing the teacher trainings, we also had people who said, oh, I'd love to move to Vermont. Can I teach for you? So we ended up with a summer camp that way because people said, oh, you should run a summer camp. And then someone would raise their hand and say, oh, I'll come teach your summer camp. And this was all under the guise of Nimble Arts, which is the company that Serenity and I created just to sort of have an insurance umbrella over the performing and teaching that we were doing. Eventually, we started a professional training program again because a bunch of us were together creating work in a very short period of time one summer. And we said, hey, this is really fun that we're all doing this at the same time. And we all have the same deadline that we have to get to when we're creating work. So we said, who wants to have a professional circus program? And, you know, 14 people joined a part-time 6-month circus program. And then we just kept going. And before we knew it, it was this big school. And then Serenity especially spearheaded a vision of turning that school into a not-for-profit. So I'm going to pass the rest of that conversation over to Serenity to talk about that.
Yeah, it was interesting at the time that the school was growing, we were trying to figure out what we wanted to do with it because it was certainly outgrowing our personal capacity. We were still touring and performing. I had 3 kids. 2 things really tipped the balance to wanting to become a not-for-profit. One is that we wanted to be able to fund outreach with a more focus, and outreach is not something that income comes into. And we'd always given, like if there was a class that had 6 people in it, at least 1 or 2 of those spots were scholarship. So we'd always done that. But in order to really focus on outreach, we knew that we needed to be able to get some funding sources. And the other one was the building. You know, we were in a 16-foot old facility on the 3rd floor of the Cotton Mill. I was doing a lot of work with people with disabilities, working with Lindsay Butcher in Europe, working with the Paralympic legacy there. And it was not an accessible building. That really tipped the decision to apply to become a not-for-profit. And we created the New England Center for Circus Arts as its own separate entity. And I'm just amazed sometimes when I look at this place that we've built. It has certainly grown way beyond Elsie and I. We are now employees here. It is its own organization run by a board of directors. We have 50 people who work at NECA, and NECA just announced our new executive director hire. We're just really excited to have another person who's really, really smart to do all the financial stuff that needs to be done here at NECA.
And I just want to put a plug in that when we say we have 50 people who work for us, we live in a town that is about 12,000 people. And so from its inception in 2007, and from when we started teaching in Brattleboro in 2002, this community and all of the people who've, you know, made NECA a success have created an incredible circus program, basically in the middle of rural America. And I'm always in awe of all the people who've helped us get that off the ground and make it happen.
That's so fabulous. Congratulations on all that, awesome. That work. And as you continue to move it forward, it's fabulous.
So I know that you do a lot of workshops. Is that something you do through NECA or do you do that privately?
We still wear the Nimble Arts hat and we still work for NECA. So my job at NECA is director of programming. So I create lots and lots of workshops, except when we're in a pandemic and nobody can cross state borders. We're in a tri-state area, so our student body is really limited because none of our Massachusetts and New Hampshire regular students can come to us. But our workshops have been international. For example, last February, we had almost 80 people come for a rope meeting, which was basically, you know, 30 ropes hanging in the ceiling with 80 people doing rope tricks for 4 days. It was really cool. But that's my role at NECA, is to be able to create workshops. I also teach some of those workshops, and so does Serenity. But most of the workshops that we get to run, we actually go away from NECA and sort of get little sabbatical chunks here and there so that we can basically juice up our teaching by going outside of our current community and to teach in other places. And Serenity especially has done a lot of work in England teaching workshops there. So most of our workshops that we're currently teaching, and when I say currently, that's without COVID, are away from NECA.
You've talked about this a little bit in mentioning the different teacher trainings that you have done, but to more specifically ask about it, can you describe the teaching philosophy that you have in regards to training someone to be an aerial instructor? What that background should ideally be, specific things that they should be doing to really be the best at that particular role?
We actually have a mission in our teacher training, and it's both important for the teachers that we're teaching and the students that we're teaching. So the Nimble Arts mission is that we teach to the heart of the student. So what the student's goal is always trumps what my goal is for them. So I might teach someone and be like, oh my God, you could be the most amazing contortionist ever. But if they don't want to be a contortionist, it's not up to me to tell them or force them to do it. And so that is the philosophy that we espouse when we teach teachers. So different teachers may have different goals as well. Some may want to be teaching the next elite level, high-end trapeze artist. And many of them actually just want to teach social circus, where the skill is not the end product, where the process and the experience is the end product. So we really try to help aspiring teachers understand what the safety fundamentals are, what the skill sets are, and then how they use those really will be different depending on who they are and what their goals are. So we have a mentor program where we will help someone, say if they're a teacher who wants to work with social circus, we'll help them gain additional skills beyond just how to teach a trick, whether it might be rigging or psychology and therapeutic training, or if they just want to be someone who teaches elite level athletes, they might need to get more anatomy and physiology training or do more specific apparatus-based teacher trainings. And we have levels of training as well. So if you're wanting to teach trapeze, you'll take the trapeze track. Or if you want to teach acrobatics, we have an acrobatics teacher training, although that's still in development.
Awesome. Elsie, you wrote me that you had just finished teaching a class that was about vocabulary and linguistics on aerial fabric. So I'm curious about that and also what your thoughts are on standardization of, you know, naming and all those types of things.
Oh, yeah. I had such a fun class that day. We have a teacher who came to us through our teacher training program. So she did the Nimble Arts aerial teacher training programs, and then she auditioned for NECA's professional training program. So I had the pleasure of training her for 3 years to be a professional performing artist. And then, of course, COVID came and her contracts fell through. So she's making ends meet by teaching at NECA. And she's now teaching the students in the professional training program in their evening classes, and then I get to work with them in their day classes. So there's this lovely sort of follow along of the teaching vocabulary. And what happened in this particular class is I had a student who had been in this other teacher's classes, and she was asking me some questions about the tricks that they were doing. And she was specifically asking about some of the categorization that we tend to use for vertical arts. So vertical arts is rope and aerial fabric. And for those of you who do those apparatus, there are sort of three base wraps for drops that people work with sort of through the intermediate level. After intermediate level, everything goes out the door. But basically, you can start a drop with a same side or an opposite side. And then there's something called an S wrap. And so with this particular student, we just got into all this discussion of the fact that an S wrap is part of the same family as a same side wrap. And so a lot of the drops that you do can be done with variations with those two pre-wraps. Whereas if you've got an opposite side wrap, it sort of has its own category of skills. So not to get too deep into it, we started talking about that conversation. And part of that was me also helping her understand what the lineage was. So for example, there's a trick called the double star. That's a fairly standard vocabulary point for, I would say, Americans, Canadians, and most Europeans. South America and Africa have slightly different vocabulary lineages. So I don't know what it's called in those areas. But the double star used to be called a Ramon because it was named after the man who was popularizing rope. He went to school with Fred Deb, I believe. But basically, we have this really popular trick that originally was named after a person. It was sort of thought of as his choreography. And through the years, we realized that calling a trick after a person didn't help us parse out what that skill was. So by calling something a double star, we've introduced some of the language that allows us to recognize that it's a double of something and the shape of a star. I could totally geek out on vocabulary and stuff. I think the linguistic is really fun because the other side of this is also figuring out who named a thing. You know, there's a trick on the trapeze called the Montreal, and it's called the Montreal because Aloysia Gavray, who was Serenity's first trapeze partner, went to Montreal to visit a friend who was at the National Circus School, learned that trick, brought it back to San Francisco, couldn't for the life of her figure out what the translation was for the French, and maybe it didn't even have a name, and now it's called the Montreal. Serenity and I have also had a lot of fun working with other aerial teachers to actually shape the linguistics, because there's sort of the accidental naming of things. But we specifically met with a group of aerialists in New York City. It probably was early 1993, and consciously decided that rather than calling the wrap that people were using to do the Ramon wrap, we were going to call it the S wrap. And so those of you who do aerial fabric will commonly understand what the S wrap was. But for many, many years, that was just called the Ramon wrap, as in the Ramon wrap for the Ramon trick. So it's been a conscious manipulation on many people's part to create those linguistics, as well as an accidental thing that names have happened.
That's really interesting. Is there anything that we forgot to ask you that you think is particularly pertinent to this conversation?
the only thing that I would share is that I am not an expert in terms of like the circadenics, the study of circus. So a lot of the questions that you ask, I just really want to couch. They're my opinions and my breadth of experience. And I am very, very aware that circus is much bigger than I am. And the perspectives of many, many people really deserve to be heard. And I'm really, really grateful to be on this podcast. And I'm so appreciative that you invited us to be here. And I want to also just share that I'm very just sensitive to being as if my story is the only story. And I think that it's really important if anyone's curious about circus and history and the traditions to go out and learn more from other people, other cultures, and certainly the different styles of circus as well. It's a really big world out there.
Yeah, thanks, Serenity, for saying all that. And I'll add my little thoughts is that there is more of a acknowledgement happening now than there used to be of where you learn things. So if you're a practitioner of the circus arts and you take a class and your teacher teaches you something, we're really as a community trying to encourage people to learn, where did your teacher learn that trick from? What five different inspirations brought them to the choreography that they are now sharing with you? And when you put something on Instagram and you showcase your successes, to try to indicate what the lineage was that you have been blessed to learn from. And certainly if you're creating something that you haven't seen before, maybe acknowledge that you haven't seen it before, but it might exist from something else. The more that we can just express that we're not learning and doing circus in a vacuum, but that we all have lineages and our teachers have lineages, the more that we can really, I think, encourage this as a historical art form. And I think we'll also be able to take it to the future a lot more successfully as well.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being on our show and for sharing your history and being one voice out of hopefully the many we get to have a inclusive story. Is there anything that you want to plug before we let you go?
Well, I'll just say that NECA has opened up more virtual training that we never would have done before. And at first I was really cautious to teach online, but now I realize that it's a really remarkable opportunity for enhancing accessibility for people who either couldn't afford to come train here or physically couldn't get here. So, you know, just a plug for virtual training in a way that I would not have said 6 months ago. So NECA has virtual training options. We also have our professional training program is accepting applications. The first deadline is January 17th, and then there's rolling deadlines after that. So I know that this podcast goes out after that, but we're accepting applications for our professional training program that has been able to carry on even in the COVID because we're all wearing masks and staying 6 foot apart and really training hard.
I'd also like to say that we are planning, if all goes well, to have a regular summer at NECA with our showcase workshops that have been taking place for years and years and years. So we have weekend-long workshops, week-long workshops, six-week-long workshops, and sort of like professional boot camp performance workshops. And because Vermont is so rural and is right now is doing an awesome job with the pandemic, we really, 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 really think that it's going to be an awesome summer to be in Vermont as long as people can travel. So hopefully we can see a lot of people coming and sharing the awesome NECA world.
Awesome.
That's awesome.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Bye.
Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Aerial Evolution. On our next episode, we will have New Zealand aerialist Deb Pope recounting the scrappy early days of being an aerialist in London and the joy she has found teaching aerial in her native land.
And we would love to hear from you. If you have questions or comments about this episode, come and find us on Instagram or Facebook at Aerial Evolution Pod. And both those links will be in the show notes as well. And stay tuned for future episodes with other amazing aerialists releasing every 2 weeks. Until next time.